ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
9 months ago, the TGA ruled that psychedelics could be used in conjunction with talk therapy in Australia for some mental health conditions. But there are still only 9 psychiatrists registered as approved prescribers. Is that too much? Too little? Too soon, given the evidence base we have available? Or not soon enough for people with treatment-resistant depression and PTSD? Several clinicians have generously agreed to join us to explain how these treatments work today. It's quite a cast of people that we have with us today. Dr. John Lahn is a consultant psychiatrist and co-founder of the PAX Centre in Perth. John, welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Lichnitsky is a senior research fellow in Monash University's Department of Psychiatry, and he's head of their clinical psychedelic lab as well. Paul, great to have you with us.
Hi, Hilary.
And Associate Professor Shalini Arunagiri is Clinical Director at Turning Point, the statewide centre for addiction and mental health in Victoria, in Melbourne. She sits on the College of Psychiatry's Steering Committee for Psychedelic-Assisted Therapy too. Shalini, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
John Lahn, just last week, I understand you started treating your first client from the general public for PTSD using the drug MDMA, and that's outside of a clinical trial. This is a really new field. What made you feel confident that now was the time to proceed?
Well, I mean, the opportunity is before us in the sense that the TGA made that decision last year, which was somewhat earlier than probably most of us were expecting. It's taken however many months it is since February last year to get to this point. So I don't think there's been any rush in that sense. I mean, I was positioned as the co-founder of a specialist psychological trauma centre in Perth, which we've built up over the last 6 or 7 years. I guess I was well positioned to look at this opportunity and consider it carefully and to see how it might fit in with the other treatments we're already using, which are the more standard evidence-based treatments for PTSD and related conditions. So it doesn't feel to have been a rush in the sense that once the TGA made their decision, we all realised there were going to be a lot of regulations to navigate. And it did take the best part of 12 months to get the authorised prescriber status. And as you say, we've treated our first patient or started the treatment of our first patient just in the last week under the authorised prescriber umbrella. So it certainly doesn't feel like it's been a rush. It feels it's been a very carefully thought through and carefully planned trajectory so far.
We received a statement from Professor Richard Harvey, John, the chair of the RANZCP, College of Psychiatrists, chair of the Psychiatrist Steering Group on Psychedelic-Assisted Therapy. And he said, in part, there's still insufficient evidence in the field to suggest widespread efficacy of psychedelic drugs, especially outside of clinical settings. What's your response to that?
Well, that sounds like a very broad statement across all psychedelic drugs and conditions. I mean, certainly the TGA has only sanctioned the use of psychedelic treatment for 2 conditions and 2 specific drugs. So it's a relatively narrow, opportunity that's before psychiatrists at the moment. It's certainly not a free-for-all. And as I've said, you know, the regulations are very much in place that really, I suppose, are prompting this discussion because there's not a great deal of treatment going on around the country.
No, only 9 psychiatrists registered so far. John, tell us just briefly how the dosing and treatment will work with patients that you'll be working with over coming weeks. What will that combination of medication and therapeutic support look like?
Well, just to outline briefly, for the PTSD treatment with MDMA, there are 3 dosing sessions, roughly a month apart. And for that session, the patient comes into the clinic for the whole day. And there are 2 therapists, 2 clinicians with the patient for the whole day. So it's quite a labor-intensive type of treatment in that sense. So there are 3 dosing sessions with the MDMA. And then in between those sessions, there are several what we call integration sessions, which don't involve MDMA. And those are where the therapists work with the patient to integrate the experiences from the dosing. There are preparation sessions before they even have their first dosing session. And there are sessions at the end of the treatment course. So it's over 3 months in duration. And there are a lot of clinician hours involved in the whole process. And this is consistent with, we've designed our treatment to be consistent with international evidence from the studies that have been done.
Dr. Paul Lichnitsky, you've opened a new clinic in Melbourne, which I believe will start treating its first patients soon too. But some people on the flip side are asking why it's taken so long since the TGA's decision to get treatments available to some people. What's your view? Is it about the training opportunities for therapists, the availability of therapists, the willingness of institutions to take these treatments on board? What's happening?
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, I've definitely heard the cries of too soon, too fast turning into cries of, too slow.
Well, possibly they're coming from different sectors of the community.
Yes, absolutely. I guess I have a fortunate position in that while this is a whole new set of policy changes and changes in terms of implementation, we've had the opportunity to be working in psychedelic therapies for a number of years now within the lab that I established at Monash University in 2020. So we have the largest group of experienced researchers and clinicians in this space who have been doing this, almost every day of the week for years now. And what's clear to us is that there are a whole set of rather unique and unusual challenges and capacities with respect to delivering psychedelic therapies sensibly and safely and well. And this TGA decision, while it was unprecedented and took all of us by surprise, and I do have a lot of sympathy for the view that it's premature, in many respects, what's rolling out now is potentially a much more slowed down and cautious approach to implementation than what we would see just probably next year or the year after as these drugs start to become listed as approved medicines. So, we have multiple barriers to entry and guardrails. This is why it's taking all of these clinics quite a long time to set up, and that's good. And my view is that, given the unique features of this kind of treatment approach or this class of therapies, even if we all just sat by and waited and did nothing until these drugs got registered on the list of approved medicines, we would then have the challenge of schooling up and developing capacities and learning how to deliver this well as a community of healthcare professionals. But in that context, when these are approved medicines, there are far fewer guardrails and so on. So, my sense here is that in terms of the scheduling of these drugs, which is what the TGA did on the 1st of July, the scheduling is appropriate. These drugs, psilocybin and MDMA, don't appropriately fit into the prior schedule that they were in. In fact, there's a case to be made that psilocybin ought to have been downscheduled 5 decades ago. But in addition to that, they've rolled out this authorized prescriber scheme, which is not unique to psychedelics. There are many drugs that qualified medical practitioners can prescribe that are not listed as approved medicines. Mm. And so my view is that, there are just a whole set of challenges to doing this well, and that's unavoidable. And at this point in time, things are rolling out quite cautiously, quite slowly. And my hope is that, everybody who's getting involved in this, pays attention to the prior art, of which there's a great deal, and understands the methods of use and trains up really well and monitors themselves and is transparent and so on. In that, if people are doing that, then we can proceed stepwise and cautiously.
Getting some really interesting texts on this, Paul, John and Shalini. Charles says, I have suffered from complex trauma and PTSD my entire adult life. My relationships have failed and I'm unable to work. I would like affordable access to psychedelic treatments. I'm despondent about the gatekeeping and barriers and, like countless others, will probably have to seek unauthorised, non-legal or unregulated options. Caroline too says, please ask your guests if the cost is going to come down soon for psilocybin treatment. I'm desperate to participate. John Lahn, I understand you've been talking to health insurers about this very issue. What do you think about the chances of the cost coming down? Because I understand it costs about $30,000 to go through the kind of treatment that you're offering.
Yeah, it is close to $30,000, just under the full cost. And most of that cost is clinician time. So it's because this is a form of psychotherapy, but an intensive form of psychotherapy that drives the cost rather than the the substance itself. So we've been talking to various stakeholders in the sort of insurance field, third party payers, if you like. I think there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of interest at this stage, but so far nobody has really committed to getting involved in funding these treatments. Mm. I suspect that's just a process that we have to go through. And obviously, you know, they're looking at data, so generating real-world data, which we'll be doing in the next few months, is going to be an important part of that process.
Mm. I do want to ask a couple of other questions. I'm aware that we've got very limited time and this is such a huge issue. We're speaking with Dr. John Lahn, who's a consultant psychiatrist, co-founder of the PAX Centre in Perth, Dr. Paul Lichnitsky, who's a senior research fellow in Monash Uni's Department of Psychiatry and the head of a new clinic in Melbourne called the Clarion Centre, and Associate Professor Shalini Arunagiri, who's clinical director at Turning Point in Melbourne, the statewide Centre for Addiction and Mental Health, and she's been involved in developing guidelines around this too. Shalini, I want to ask you in a moment about that, but Paul, just quickly, the Professor Richard Harvey from the College of Psychiatrists also said to us in his statement, managing consumer expectations is critical because these psychedelics aren't magic drugs or quick fixes. How do you do that in the context of a privately funded treatment and in the context of some of the media reporting that we've seen? How do you balance what might be the public expectation of what they're going to get out of this treatment with what you've seen as the real world outcomes?
Yeah, it's an important question. You know, there is a lot of hype in this space, and then also there is a lot of potential. There's a lot of promise. You know, we see this on a weekly basis in our lab. We see the ways in which, when this therapy is delivered well, it can genuinely transform people's lives. But it is not, in most cases, a one and done. It's not a passive treatment, and so managing expectations is important. I mean, we need to do that in terms of our, you know, engagement with the public in general, but that starts also in the first engagement at any of these clinics or when you come into our lab for treatment within a trial, because it's essential that people recognize the challenges associated with this, the psychological challenges associated with this form of treatment. It's really courageous work, and also that it is not a passive drug-based treatment. You know, as John says, this is a form of augmented psychotherapy, and the way we get good outcomes is through a process of supporting our clients or patients or participants to make courageous and impressive changes in their lives. So this is an ongoing process. There's going to be hype, but there's also a lot of stigma, and there's all kinds of misunderstandings about this. And I think as the professional communities and the general public become more aware of psychedelic therapies, I think the reality on the ground will become clearer. We recently SBS released a documentary focused on the work in our lab. It's on SBS On Demand, and I've heard from many people that that was the most honest and kind of compelling account in a documentary of psychedelic therapies, and that's an example of a kind of, you know, public service announcement, if you like, that gives you a bit of a sense of what actually happens in these kinds of treatments.
Mm, as you say, there's a lot of public interest in different aspects of it, as our text line is attesting to at the moment too. Shalini, you sat on the College of Psychiatrists committee that developed a clinical memorandum for clinicians after that TDA decision to try and give clinicians some operating parameters. And it's our understanding that you do that when there aren't enough operating parameters and people are a bit unclear about how to proceed. What were you trying to guard against? What were the concerns and have they been allayed?
Yeah, thanks, Laurie. I think one of the things that's coming up, I think, from both what John and Paul have touched on is the fact that this is still early in the piece for this type of treatment. And as Paul's mentioned, this is about psychotherapy with a medication. So it's actually quite an interesting model in that way. And so from our perspective of the college, and as you've heard from Richard Harvey, one of the things that we were really interested in doing, first and foremost, was thinking about safety. And when we think about any medical innovation, really what we think about there is that it's been through sort of clinical trials, potentially in hundreds of people, often over decades.
Has that happened?
And it hasn't happened yet for multiple psychedelics for multiple indications. And so really in this space, what we're thinking about is thinking about informed consent for the person when they attend a treatment, that they know what those risks are, what safety looks like. And for whom also, we're interested in what works for whom as well, and also what those risks are for people who may be at risk of developing side effects or adverse effects from accessing this kind of treatments. And that evidence is, you know, there's certainly growing evidence in the trial space. And as you've heard from Paul, that work has really been led by his lab here in Australia. But I think what we're doing is this field in evolution, and we're trying to put those guardrails in place and ensure that we understand also the data that's coming through from clinical practice, as John's touched on.
Well, yeah, should we have waited for more clinical trials to get that longer-term data and that broader bulk of scientific evidence base before we pressed ahead with offering it to the general public, even at great expense?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the points you're making there is about that great expense, and just wanted to touch on that point made earlier. I think that expense is about that model that we've got right now, and touching on that point that it is a field in evolution, I don't think that that's necessarily the model we'll continue to have over the next decade. It is a process of trying different things and seeing what that looks like in an implementation setting, so that is accessible and affordable for more people rather than the model that we've got right now. So that is something that's going to be, I think, coming through. But I think in terms of, you know, that is it too soon? I think what we've got now, a year down the track, I think, from that decision to reschedule, nearly coming up to a year. And I think that's where we've kind of, you know, the capacity, you're kind of seeing 9 people have kind of registered. I think that evidence is starting to come through slowly.
Yep. So when you say it might be a different model in the future, do you mean it might not need the 2 therapists in conjunction, or do you mean it might perhaps be funded by health insurers or even under Medicare?
Lots of different things. I think all of those are up for discussion, and all of those things are things that I think within trial settings people are tweaking or working with, kind of thinking, what are the key ingredients? How do we do this so that we can actually have this accessible? Because the current models we've heard, 2 therapists, multiple sessions, long sessions, all of the clinician hours in these models are what adds to the cost. And it's kind of thinking within an Australian setting, how do we make this a real world treatment?
Well, then you're involved in research, Shalini, as well as being a clinical director at Turning Point. Tell me about a trial that you're assisting with using MDMA in conjunction with therapy for people who have PTSD and alcohol use disorder. How will that work?
Yeah, so this trial is running both in Melbourne at our site in Turning Point and also in Sydney at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, and it's run by the University of Sydney. So when we finish the trial, which is some time away, it'll be the largest trial conducted to date, looking at both those indications, so looking at PTSD and alcohol together. We know that that's really common, that people often use alcohol to cope with trauma and cope with PTSD. And so this trial will be one of the first to look at that. And so within that context of treatment, both those sites are recruiting, and both those sites are actually looking at a gold standard sort of therapy option that exists already for PTSD and alcohol, and we're trying to understand the addition of MDMA, does that actually catalyse, does that help the type of treatment we're offering?
Dr. Paul Luknitsky, you are the chief principal investigator on various psychedelic trials at Monash University, and later this year you'll be able to publish the results of a study looking at the use of psychedelics and therapy to treat anxiety. I know it's pre-publication, but can you tell us anything about what you've seen about the effectiveness of psychedelics with anxiety so far?
Yeah, so that was, a very special project that just concluded very recently. And again, that specific project was tracked in the SBS documentary that came out last month. I can't speak to a whole set of kind of specific data that we're analysing now, but I can say that we witnessed up close both the incredible potential for psilocybin alongside, you know, substantial psychotherapy to provide benefit to people's lives. And we're now looking at data that's going out to 1.5 years follow-up, and we're seeing some impressive signs of enduring benefit in the longer term. We also saw just how, you know, difficult it is to deliver this form of treatment, particularly when it's brief and, you know, in the clinical trials, it's a kind of one-size-fits-all model. For various scientific reasons and other reasons. So, there's a lot still to be done with respect to developing best practice in psychedelic therapies. And this is one of the opportunities that these new authorized prescriber clinics offer, is the opportunity to move beyond, the cookie cutter one-size-fits-all approach in clinical trials, which has its merits for sure, to something that more resembles, community-based practice. So at the Clarion Clinics here in Melbourne that has commenced screening its first clients, we have a default model of care that lasts for 9 months. And there are a whole set of other kind of, programmatic features to that treatment model that come from lessons that we've learned in the lab over the last few years. And that's one of my views. There will be a whole diverse set of ways in which we deliver this treatment sensibly in the future. But my sense is we shouldn't only focus on the cost. Ultimately, we should be focusing on the cost effectiveness, which is a combination of the degree to which you can support enduring benefit in people's lives and the cost that incurs to the payer. And it may be the case that more substantial programs of treatment, even that cost more, may get us more cost-effective outcomes in the end. And the critical thing is collecting the data, the kind of health economics data in the language of the Medicares and the insurers of the world, because ultimately that will be the pivotal factor in whether this actually can make a difference at the population level.
Yes, and before we go, I just do need to ask, when we talk about the money and the funding, John Lahn, the part of your clinic that's administering this therapy, the MPACT Centre, is partly owned by a biotech company, Emyria, which is interested in drug development. Does that open you up to potential pressure on the way you operate if it's a company that might be more interested in the drug side of things than the talk therapy side, which is what the TGA has said we can do? We can only do them together.
Yeah, just a couple of quick points. I mean, Emyria, it's a small biotech company, but it's a clinical biotech. And one arm of Emyria is about developing clinics and clinical services. And that's the focus for MPACT. There's no product that Emyria has that we're using. We're using internationally acquired clinical grade MDMA. So It's a broader issue that has to be considered, for sure, but I don't think it affects us. And the amalgamation of Emyria with PACT Centre has enabled us to get this off the ground. So I think that's another thing. Most private psychiatrists, private clinics are just not resourced to put this kind of thing together. And that's another thing that's slowing down the processes around the country.
Look, so, I very much appreciate all of you joining us today. Obviously, this is part of a much, much bigger discussion that I wish we had time for today. I'm sure we'll follow it up in future. But thanks again, John, Paul and Shalini, for joining us on Life Matters.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. John Lahn is a consultant psychiatrist, co-founder of the PACT Centre in Perth. Very much appreciate him joining us on Eastern Time. Dr. Paul Lichnitsky is a senior research fellow in Monash Uni's Department of Psychiatry in Victoria. He's the head of a new clinic in Melbourne called the Clarion Centre. And Associate Professor Shalini Arunagiri is clinical director at Turning Point, the statewide centre for addiction and mental health in Melbourne. And she's on the College of Psychiatry Steering Committee for Psychedelic-Assisted Therapy.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations, live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.